So America has had a love-hate relationship with alcohol for, well, maybe since the nation was founded. And since we've been talking about renunciation in this hour, we thought it would be interesting to look back at America's brief experiment with collective, state-sponsored and enforced sobriety, prohibition. Historian Lisa McGurr has just come out with a revisionist history in which she traces the war on drugs, big government, and the penal industrial complex back to, yep, prohibition. Raymond Tungekar has been reading the book.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, Raymond.
Thank you so much for coming in today. I read your book over the weekend, and it's fascinating. I had no idea. I mean, you know, when I think of prohibition, I think of flappers and the roaring 20s and like speakeasies, but I had no idea that there's this dark underside.
Yes, I mean, that is kind of what the book reveals, is the side of prohibition that we've known so little about, because what we've largely seen is this, you know, flapper side, which is not an incorrect portrait, just a very partial one. So my book tries to tell the other part of the story that's been missing.
I'm curious, where did the inspiration of prohibition even come from? I mean, what led the U.S. to try out this incredibly ambitious state-sponsored legal renunciation of alcohol?
Well, in order to understand that, you have to understand that prohibition came out of a far deeper and longer temperance movement to discipline oneself and to control one's own drinking, to renounce or to abstain from imbibing. But the prohibitionist crusade at its core was led by religious men and women who approached it with a very absolutist sensibility. And they targeted no longer so much personal drink and this notion of self-discipline, but rather increasingly the drinking of others, and particularly in the urban saloon.
Well, and what explains this shift? I mean, how come it went from being an individual responsibility to something that would require, you know, government intervention?
Well, it's multifaceted. I mean, first of all, you have to remember that the period in which prohibition gains traction is a moment where there are enormous amounts of problems of industrial capitalism that are under discussion, and it's the high wave of the progressive era reform ethos. So at that moment, men and women are looking toward the state, looking toward the federal government for solutions. So it's also important to remember this is a moment where there's massive waves of immigration transforming the core of urban centers. So overnight, it seems like Chicago, New York are becoming unfamiliar places to many of the men and women who had inhabited them earlier because of these massive waves of largely European and often Catholic men and women who shared habits of drink as part of their rituals of family and culture.
So you're saying that alcohol and the saloon basically became a symbol for a whole set of social problems and ways to tackle changing demographics?
In some ways, it's a real social problem, right? Laboring men are stopping on their way home in saloons, and they're on very tight wages. Of course, there's many other reasons that there's a lot of poverty, but it's an easily identifiable issue. And so it comes as a stand-in, I think, for many issues. And it's exactly right that it has very much to do with the fact that these are sort of this laboring class is largely a sort of immigrant working class with different sets of rituals, different sets of culture and values than many of those middle class Protestant elites.
Okay, so the 18th Amendment gets ratified, you know, prohibition becomes law, and the Volstead Act is passed to enforce it. Well, what effect did this have on the prison population? I mean, how would you compare the prison population before prohibition and afterwards?
Prohibition vastly expands the federal prison population and vastly expands the federal government's role in crime control across the board. There is about a doubling of the prison population in both federal and state prisons. Now, the numbers are not comparable at all in terms of today when we think about this absolutely colossal prison state or carceral state, as some have called it. But you see the way in which a campaign against a recreational substance in this early moment where the state is far weaker and far less muscular has all sorts of ramifications, A, in rising prison numbers, but also in terms of muscling the penal state at the federal level.
Well, and I should just point out right now that this was an incredibly ambitious policing effort, right? I mean, the country had not seen anything like it up to that point.
It's absolutely correct that there was an exponential growth in policing. But of course, given the absolute sort of ambitions, and really, one could say, relatively impossible ambitions of eradicating liquor traffics from shore to shore, they were came nowhere near to success. So one of the things I talk about in the book is what I call the emergence of a dry enforcement army. Partly the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is still very much, working for enforcement, the Anti-Saloon League, but also the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, how does that work, though? I mean, how are those citizen enforcement groups able to actually, apply the law? I mean, can they just, organize and say, okay, we're going to protect this neighborhood?
One of the stories I tell is the series of raids that occurred in Williamson County in southern Illinois, where you had local Klan exalted Cyclops and also a county booster concerned about the new Italian Catholic population that was competing for jobs in a very tight labor market, who basically goes to Washington to meet Roy Haynes, who is the Prohibition Commissioner at the time, and to say, we want your support to clean up conditions in Williamson County. And Haynes says, I would love to help out, but I don't have an army to do so. And the response is, well, we do. And that army are really the foot soldiers of the campaign, largely Ku Klux Klan men, who conduct a series of raids, which are first authorized, they're deputized by Prohibition Bureau officials. And there's a series about four or five raids in which essentially the local immigrant community is targeted and also terrorized. And the drink issue is used instrumentally as a campaign of terror against their communities.
And I got to say, when I read this book, frankly, I was flabbergasted. I had no idea that there were all these unintended consequences. And I think that's because we seem to view the Prohibition era as this really unique blip in our nation's history, that it's, kind of this laughable failure and a prime example of government overreach and the perils of regulating behavior. But ultimately, that was in our history. That was in our past, and we've moved on, and we're essentially a different country. Do you think there's anything wrong with thinking of that? Thinking of Prohibition as some kind of, unique outlier?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is one of the central problems, and the way that Prohibition has been misunderstood is partly, I think this, this notion that it was driven by these kind of puritanical zealots of another era, and thank God, we put that in the past. And I think that in reality, that has been a huge mistake because, in fact, it is the origin point of many campaigns that are still ongoing. And we still have this kind of penal approach toward other recreational narcotic substances. And the implications have been devastating for many communities. And so I do think a revisit of Prohibition can really help us better understand both our past as well as our present.
There's also, it strikes me that this whole era also is kind of romanticized in a way, right? I mean, bars that fashion themselves after speakeasies are making a comeback. Flapper culture is highly regarded. Do you see our current culture being nostalgic about Prohibition in some way?
I do think that there is a lot of nostalgia around Prohibition, and I understand it in a certain way, in part because what we have focused on is the rebelliousness that it generated, the flappers, the speakeasies, the avant-garde, adventurous world of subterranean nightlife leisure that flouted directly the law. And I think that is not an incorrect portrait. I mean, in places like Harlem and the South Side of Chicago saw these amazingly new, rich worlds of experimental leisure, often cross-racial, worlds in which jazz found new venues. But it's just that I think that nostalgia needs to be tempered with the other side of that reality, which is that a very small segment of elite men and women could participate in those protected spaces, and it came at the cost to the neighborhoods surrounding those underground worlds of leisure.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much. This has been fascinating.
You're welcome. Take care.
Lisa McGurr and Raymond Tangekar. Lisa's a historian at Harvard, and they were talking about her new book, The War on Alcohol.